Welcome to BNA's audio conference, eDiscovery for mid-sized companies and law firms and records management. Before we get started, I wanted to thank a few people for their support and assistance on this program. First of all, special counsel has supported the program, and we also welcome their guests who are listening in at various special counsel sites. And also, ARMA International is supporting the program, and some of their members are listening in on the program. One important announcement about CLE credits. If you would like to receive the credits, you must visit attend.bna.com after the program and complete your CLE information. Again, that's attend, A-T-T-E-N-D, .bna.com. And please do that within a day or two after the program to receive CLE credits. Now I'd like to turn the program over to our moderator, Carl Shinneman. Carl? Take it away.
Great. Thank you very much. Does size matter for electronic records management? That's basically what we're calling this program. And first of all, electronic discovery is making its way into the court system in more and more decisions. It's estimated in a recent panel presentation that 75% of all e-discovery cases involve the middle market. So it's not just the big companies and law firms which face these issues. Most cases involve smaller players, many of whom might have been working on one of their first electronic discovery matters. Law firms and companies are being forced to consider email, databases, websites, instant messaging, VoIP phone records, online collaborative tools like Facebook's, and old legacy databases and software when they approach litigation. They have to preserve this evidence at the beginning of the litigation and then produce all relevant evidence as long as it's not reasonably inaccessible. This is a new and growing field with revenues now exceeding $2 billion, according to a survey just released on August 2, 2007 by George Socia. This is the first time this topic has been presented targeting electronic discovery and electronic record management at mid-sized law firms and companies instead of huge law firms and huge companies. Before we start, I'd like to add a couple of comments. First of all, the panelists have lots of experience in electronic discovery and electronic records management, both in large matters and within the middle market. The panel we've assembled are comprised of three attorneys from law firms ranging in size from 100 to 200 attorneys, one in-house attorney who's a consultant now, one IT consultant, and the president of ARMA, American Records Management Association International. I'm going to be using the phrases middle market and mega company market for e-discovery and electronics records management to distinguish between large e-discovery matters and what we're talking about today. What is a middle market depends on where you're located and maybe what type of law firm you work with or where you are on the Fortune 500 list. What we're using it to mean are law firms between 40 and 200 attorneys and companies which are not on the Fortune 500 list. I agree that covers a lot of ground, but considering all the other panels on e-discovery I've seen are clearly top-heavy with the mega company market, I believe our imperfect breakdown is a step in the right direction to cover material that's generally not covered in those presentations and hopefully is going to produce some useful dialogue. The framework of the presentation is not going to be a comprehensive discussion of e-discovery issues and records management issues. There are 2 to 3 day conferences on these topics. What we decided instead to be more practical is to begin by discussing 3 cases which involved a collection of smaller law firms and or smaller companies, which have been decided within the last year and a half. I've summarized in your materials the important facts in the materials you've received, as well as the important issues we're going to focus on, and I'm going to read those. We're going to talk about the issues involved and how they impact the middle market. We're also going to talk generally about some of the differences between the middle market and the mega company market in the second half of the presentation. We might not cover issues like how to get electronically stored evidence, information admitted into evidence, or trends with the metadata, or maybe the state of the proposed rules involving protecting against a waiver of privilege. But you're welcome to ask questions at the end of the presentation, too, if you have questions you'd want answered. In the last 15 minutes or so, you can email those questions to me, and that's in your materials as well at the Q&A section. It's carl.shinneman@specialcounsel.com. I'm not going to spell it. You'll find it in the materials. This email address is if you have Blackberries, is totally suitable to be on your Blackberry and use. I also wanted to informally introduce the panelists. the full bios of this esteemed panel would take 15 minutes to cover, but I'd encourage you to scan them later. The outside lawyers on the panel are Monica Lattin from Carrington, Coleman, Sloman, and Blumenthal in Dallas, David Reese from Thorpe Reed and Armstrong in Pittsburgh, and Thomas Gilson from Lewis and Rocha in Phoenix. They're all extremely experienced in e-discovery. They speak frequently on this topic at some of the most prestigious electronic discovery conferences in the country, and their law firms are all between 100 and 200 attorneys in size. Carol Chocksky is president of ARMA International, a 10,000-member group, which has put a lot of focus on identifying best practices for electronic records management. Carol has authored a book on electronic records management. She also provides consulting for both mega companies and middle-market companies on records management. She's also undertaken some groundbreaking research on records management process within companies. This is her second program with me, so I'm glad to have her back. The corporate representatives are really consultants who've worked in some of the most sophisticated companies in the country. Kevin Esposito and Jim Mikowitz go way back with me to the initial B&A presentation in 2004. That presentation gave birth to a board game I built called Discovery Land, which is an e-discovery project management tool. So it's good to have them both on board here today. Who knows what we'll design. Kevin held positions at Pfizer and UPS, and Jim at DuPont and Tyco. They're two of the most sought-after speakers in the e-discovery field for good reason. They're both well-rounded in corporate politics, process development, law, IT, and an extremely important skill in this field, they've got a good sense of humor. And that's really important because to be a straight shooter in this field, you got to be able to make people smile. My name's Carl Shinneman. I developed this program. I'm an entrepreneur, lawyer, MBA, and consultant in this field. I've strived to create an NPR-type show in the e-discovery field, which is free from politics and self-interest and filled with some of the best and most knowledgeable speakers across the e-discovery and electronic records management field. Now let's get started with the program. The first section, the first case we're going to talk about is I took Spanish in high school. Cache la poudre feeds.
Cache la poudre.
Thank you. Versus Lando Lakes, which I'm more familiar with. This case talks about the trigger preservation obligations when litigation is reasonably anticipated and the implementation of legal holds of electronically stored information. The plaintiff was a 4-to-8 company, employee company suing a $6 billion company for trademark infringement. The law firms involved are a solo practitioner and a two-attorney law firm for the plaintiff and a larger Midwest-based law firm for the defendant. The facts of the case are the case involves a dispute over trademark infringement over the Profile trademark, which, go ahead, Carol.
Cache la poudre.
Feed, had used since 1991 in several states for animal feed, and Land Lakes, which rebranded 400 of their products and 36 separate brands of animal feed products into one brand Profile in 2001. The first issue was there was an allegation of Land Lakes' destruction of relevant documents through the routine elimination of email and overriding backup electronic media after April 2002 when Cache La Poudre Feeds began writing the Land O'Lakes, alerting them of the trademark issue and the desire to resolve the issue without litigation. There were letters sent on June 5, 2002 and June 17, 2003. A lawsuit was eventually filed on February 24, 2004. Now the first question, Monica Lattin. What does this case tell us about the trigger of preservation?
Thanks, Carl. What this case tells us is that the language used in communications between the parties is extremely important. As you mentioned, the two letters that were sent to Land O'Lakes in the year and 2 years before the lawsuit was filed both alluded to or specifically gave notice of a dispute between the parties, but neither letter specifically actually threatened litigation, and neither letter specifically mentioned the preservation of information. So the lesson of this case really goes to the plaintiff side of the docket, and that is to be specific, particularly if you're a lawyer. If you represent a potential plaintiff and you want to either threaten litigation or demand the preservation of evidence, you should say so. There's a great quote in this opinion that's worth reading, and the court said, "A party's duty to preserve evidence in advance of litigation must be predicated on something more than an unequivocal statement of discontent, particularly when that discontent does not crystallize into litigation for nearly 2 years." Any other conclusion would confront a putative litigant with an intractable dilemma: either preserve voluminous records for an indefinite period at potentially great expense, or continue routine document management practices and risk a spoliation claim at some point in the future. I wonder if the court may have thought that the plaintiff was playing a game of gotcha. The communications that the plaintiff relied upon to claim that the defendant should have anticipated litigation were all drafted by a lawyer, and that lawyer could easily have stated that the defendants should preserve documents or that they intended to file suit. And so I think the balancing the burdens here, the court felt that if the plaintiff didn't think to be specific enough to threaten litigation or request the preservation of evidence, that it wouldn't necessarily be fair to put the burden on the defendant to interpret that from the letters.
Those are great points, Monica. Tom, this smaller firm got hammered in this case on the preservation issue. Is this an area where the unwary can lose the hammer of forcing preservation? Do you need to be sophisticated to trigger preservation obligation on a party?
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for having me on the panel. Well, certainly sophistication is not something that belongs to large companies or large law firms alone, and it's really a matter of knowledge, preparation, and follow-through, and really any sized law firm or company can gain the knowledge to work with these concepts. And I just have a few practical points to make here. This case, it raises the issue of e-discovery preparedness, to use a buzzword that I hate, which really means readiness, and really being getting ready in advance to deal with issues in e-discovery such as data collection and preservation. And I think it's a good practice if you're representing companies in really of any size to put together an e-discovery action plan well before any dispute arises. And what we've done is put together kind of an off-the-shelf preservation letter to be sent to opposing parties in the case, and it's something that specifically puts your opponent on notice of the need to preserve all relevant data and to stop the automatic destruction of data in the case. And, of course, you're not going to be able to use this letter as written. You've got to be able to tweak it and identify whatever the triggering event may be. But having that in your arsenal, I think, may avoid problems like the lawyer in this case had, where you've got a checklist, you've got something that's ready to go, and you can go ahead and send that right off and not worry about your you know, need to notify the other parties about their need to preserve evidence. And I just want to make one quick follow-up point about that, which is something that I call the boomerang effect, which is that you can be certain that whenever you send out a letter like this to an opposing party and saying, hey, litigation's on the horizon, you better take care to preserve everything or else you're going to be in big trouble, you're going to be sure that you're going to be getting a letter back from the other side and that you're going to be held to the same standard that you're seeking to hold your opponent. So make sure before you send a letter like that that you've got your own house in order and you understand your own obligation to preserve electronic data.
I just want to make a point. I spoke with a lawyer from the small firm involved in this matter, and it's important to note that at trial, this firm won a $12 million verdict despite the setbacks they faced in this e-discovery decision. I told them that we were going to go through this opinion, and their advice for smaller firms is that even though this was, I think, their first or second matter in the e-discovery world, that you shouldn't be intimidated by e-discovery, but take the time to go through the documents and learn the case. They felt it might have been harder for the larger defendant company to handle their obligations and get ready for trial, while all they had to do was learn everything that was given to them, and they with a small team, focused on that. So with that backdrop in mind, Carol, is the preservation at the outset of litigation from the perspective of a records manager something that companies generally have problems implementing, and why?
It really depends upon the company, and thanks, Carl, for having me on. It really depends upon the company. There are companies that take litigation terribly seriously. They have a good protocol and procedures in place. They may not have their electronic world in order, and in that case, most of them feel like they're just dodging bullets. There are others that don't take it seriously, and that's the real problem. We've found in records management, we've been called Chicken Little for the last 15 to 20 years because we've said, well, if you do that, you're going to get sued. Well, you know, companies eventually did or their neighbors did or something like that. But what eventually happened is that you had this perfect storm over the past couple of years where we've seen a lot more litigation. And finally, what we had been saying for quite a while is coming to be the case. But what we found is that many, many companies and individuals within the company with some leverage did not take that situation seriously. There were some who'd take out their checkbook and say, well, that fine is, what, about $100,000? I can write you a check now for it. I mean, sort of joking. But part of it is getting people to take it seriously, and I think that's the biggest challenge. Once you can get people to take it seriously, then when you get the information organized, you can preserve it. But until you get to that point where people take it seriously, it doesn't matter what protocols you have.
Okay. Second issue in the case we'll talk about is Land O'Lakes' alleged discovery misconduct post-filing of the litigation for not considering their backup tapes to find documents related to former employees who had left the company, not making any effort to contact employees who had left the company, and scrubbing the hard drives and recycling computers from the employees who had left the company. Jim, what does this issue in the case tell us about the preservation process and establishing legal holds?
Well, first off, I want to compliment Carol on bringing up Chicken Little. My case involves chicken feed, so I thought that was very, very good. But I'd like to really steal the wording from Tom Gilson about litigation readiness. And as much as there's a question about what was the triggering mechanism here, as Monica pointed out, I think it still is a case that talks about litigation readiness. And is there a need to have a litigation readiness plan as much as there is a need for any size company to have a crisis management plan, a disaster recovery plan? And those companies that I think could be on the brink, in this case there had been some discussion about this dispute for a while, need to have that litigation readiness plan, and not just simply a document that specs it out, but has people behind that who actually play a role in terms of collection and preservation. And when it comes to a preservation notice, that there is a person who owns that process and to actually send it out. So the last thing that I put in here was that process gets tested. It doesn't wait until, you know, the big one hits, but there is actually a testing that process. Now, having said all that, it sounds great. We're all believers in that, but frankly, Kevin and I have probably both been in a position where we've had to be salespeople. And even in large companies or the mega market companies, as Carl refers to it, there has to be a certain selling that we're really talking about how to avoid liability or avoid cost. So I think this program is really good, and I frankly am going to use this case as well as the two that follow it as really sales materials, because I think they really are ones that say, yes, it could happen to you. And therefore, here are the steps that you can take. And you don't need to have a foolproof plan, but at least even some of the basic ingredients there of a plan, again, including the roles and responsibility of people behind that plan.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Now to you, Kevin. The court was reluctant to force a review of 400 backup tapes. Do you think with middle market clients that a backup tape review would be out of the question, or is it still a process best avoided in any size litigation?
Well, first of all, thanks to everyone for having me participate today. I really appreciate it. I think that the court was very, very lenient in this particular case. I was amazed to find that they were reluctant to force a review of 400 backup tapes. Many times in my career, I've had situations where 400 backup tapes, the judge just doesn't bat an eye. There's 400, there's 500, there's 1,000. They really don't care how many there are, if there's information that might be relevant to the case there. So I think that it's absolutely not out of the question. I think that many smaller firms seem to feel that these kinds of problems are only for large firms, and that's a big mistake. This is an example of what I call weapons of mass distraction. This is the kind of thing where the other side can drop something into your case, and if you look at the actual information about this case and what is at issue, it's not really a question as to, you know, are these emails going to be the one item that's going to turn the entire case. You're looking at something whereby this company is going to have to spend a lot of money in order to try to make sure that they're either bringing their defenses to bear or that they're providing the information that they need to, that they're obligated to by the court. Having to visit those backup tapes is always best avoided, but you need to be prepared with a fallback position just in case a judge orders you to review those tapes. That fallback position should be to offer to take a sampling of the tapes that are out there. So if you've got 400 tapes, maybe you say 10% of them. Take a sampling of 40 tapes, see what's on those tapes, and then offer to say, is there anything of relevance here? If there's nothing of relevance, then there's really no need for us to do the other 300 and odd tapes that are out there. This is one of those cases where you're probably going to have to spend a little bit of money in order to make sure that you avoid spending much more.
David, what are the obligations for preservation of electronically stored information?
Well, to start, I also want to thank you for the opportunity to participate. As a preliminary point, I want to make it clear that the rules for preservation are not in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, either in the original rules or in the new amendments. They come from case law, and this case contains a pretty good discussion of them. There's pretty clear black-letter law at this point, but it gets uncertainty in its application to facts. There's two questions. First is, when does the duty to preserve arise? And second, what must be preserved? And Monica talked about this case and the letters and everything. And there's two points under when the duty arises. First of all, when the litigation or investigation starts. That's the no-brainer. You have to keep it then. The gray area is when litigation or investigation or an investigation is reasonably anticipated. And that often can be difficult to tell, and courts have kind of approached it in different ways. So you're always at risk when a court's going to look at that from hindsight. On what has to be preserved, obviously once a litigation starts, anything that's actually requested in discovery has to be preserved. But the gray area here is relevant information. You know, we have a very broad scope of discovery under Rule 26, and it's unclear how much depth or detail that goes into. The courts have given us a few hints, like you don't have to keep every shred of paper or every email, but where it is between that not everything and what's relevant is the gray area that takes a lot of study and you know, puts both attorneys and their clients at risk.
Monica, what does this case teach us about recycling hard drives while you're in litigation?
I think it provides a helpful distinction between hard drives and backup tapes. In this case, Land O'Lakes had a routine and probably unsurprising practice that when its employees left the company, their computers were scrubbed and recycled to be provided to a new employee. And this practice continued even after the lawsuit was filed. So there's no question in this part of the analysis that the duty to preserve that David just mentioned had attached, and the question was, did they comply with their duty? The court found that Land O'Lakes did not intend to deprive the plaintiff of discoverable information, but found that the recycling of those hard drives when some of the employees who left the company were alleged to have relevant information relating to lawsuits, found that the defendants were less than thorough in discharging their duty to implement adequate steps to ensure that discoverable information would be preserved. And I think on a practical level, it's much easier to preserve the hard drive of a departed employee than the more thorny question of whether to suspend a backup tape recycling program or the automatic deletion of emails. The former, that is, preserving a hard drive, typically shouldn't have a significant impact on ongoing operations of the company, as opposed to more automated processes, operation-wide processes like auto-delete functions and backup tape recycling. Obviously, this could be easily overlooked and appears to have been overlooked here. And certainly, if a company doesn't want to set the computer aside, then it's not complicated to hire a competent person or make sure that a competent person in the IT department can make an image of that hard drive. But my advice is typically that if they have enough computers that it's easier just to set the whole thing aside.
We're going to move to the second case here. It's a case, one of my favorite cases, Phoenix 4, First Strategic Resources Corporation. this case talks about the duty to search for electronically stored documents. It involves what appears to be smaller clients, as well as an 89-attorney law firm representing the defendant and a small law firm representing the plaintiff. The fact summary is that Phoenix was an investment company, and Strategic Resources Company was a related company owned by directors of Phoenix, and Phoenix was its only client. Phoenix had a shareholder dispute and stopped paying fees to SRC, which, as you might imagine, shortly thereafter ceased operations. SRC turned over all of its paper records to Phoenix in mid-2004, as well as all of Phoenix accounting records. Insurance companies for Phoenix and SRC were informed of the business disputes that existed internally at Phoenix and between SRC and Phoenix. Several shareholders retained lawyers in mid-2004. By early 2005, SRC's landlord evicted SRC from their New York offices, and SRC abandoned 10 computer workstations, which the landlord disposed of. At this time, SRC's IT specialist had also left employment with SRC. SRC did take 50 boxes with corporate records, two servers, and at least two computer workstations. One of the individual defendants from SRC, Shaq, used at least one of these servers to start a new business and house these items in his new office. On May 19, 2005, Phoenix filed a complaint against SRC, and Shaq searched his computer system and didn't find any records. He then told his outside counsel, which is today an 89-attorney law firm in New York, that he couldn't locate any records. And SRC was no longer in operation, so there were no computers or electronic information to search. The servers weren't searched because the defendants were not aware there was any information on them. Outside counsel reviewed the 50 boxes of paper, records, and produced them to Phoenix. In early February and March 2006, a freelance IT computer technician visited Shaq's office to fix a malfunctioning server and found 25 gigabytes of data, as much as 2,500 boxes of information stored in a dormant, partitioned section of the hard drive. These were invisible to the computer connected to the server because the individual computers were not set up with a drive mapping to this partitioned section of the server. This data at Shaq's request was backed up to DLT tapes, which outside counsel couldn't access, then saved on DVDs on about March 13th or 14th. The deadline for discovery of March 12th had just passed. On March 15th, outside counsel did a privilege review and responsiveness review of the new records, and on March 20th informed Phoenix of the new information. Defense counsel and Phoenix counsel, which appears to be a small law firm, met frequently over the next month and discussed the production at depositions and in correspondence. There was a dispute in the format the documents would be produced. TIFF was first offered to Phoenix, then an electronically searchable case vault format, which Phoenix did not respond to. Phoenix filed a motion for sanctions on April 20, 2006, and by April 26, the parties agreed to a hard copy production of 200 to 300 boxes. Depositions of key SRC defendants had already been taken at this time. Before we explore the issues of the case, Jim, in this case there was a dispute over a TIFF production followed by an electronically searchable case vault format. Eventually the parties agreed to paper production. What do you see as the merits of the differing forms of production, as this outcome may have been determined by the size of the parties and the size of the law firms involved in this matter?
Carl, it's interesting because typically when we say paper production, that almost sounds old-fashioned, but in many ways that can meet the criteria, which is really pervasive throughout the rules, which talks about reasonable and what is not considered reasonable. And also talks about accessible. And I'm going to throw one more term that's not in the rules, which is comfortable. And I find that there is a comfort oftentimes with what you can physically touch and see. And a lot of our clients still do, you know, some kind of electronic, or I should say a TIFF production or PDF, but some kind of hard copy production of some sort because there's a lot of comfort. Now, having said that, what's interesting about this case is that it does involve some accounting records, and oftentimes those type of records, financials of some sort, there is going to be some underlying type of metadata which cannot be seen, obviously, on just kind of a TIFF production. So oftentimes, I think in these cases, a form of production isn't simply a paper production or it's all an electronic production or it's a native production. It really can be sometimes a combination. And there's what I call level treatments. And if there are those that have more financial, they could be spreadsheets, God forbid, if they're databases, I think they fall into a different format. And oftentimes you need some kind of, I'll call it, native form for it to be actually considered accessible and readable by the other party. So I think those are considerations. The other ones, which really do not come up necessarily in this case, which go into what type of, what form of production, has to do with there is a lot of redactions that are necessary. And as much as native form of production has become a popular term, it's, and also many people misinterpret the rules to say, well, everything now is going to be a native production, there are some drawbacks right now with some of the technologies that are out there that don't necessarily allow for redactions in native format, and also for numbering. I mean, a lot of the technologies are improving, but there can be some drawbacks to that. So really, those are just a lot of considerations. The last thing I'll just say about that is I think a common strategy in the past has been to bury them with paper and as a producing party. And now the question is, do you want to bury them with bytes instead? And I don't necessarily hold to that because I think a lot of the rules say that kind of strategy will not necessarily go unnoticed, and they just don't want to go ahead and bury the other side. So those are just my comments as far as the form of production, I guess considerations as far as production.
Okay, the first issue in the case was that Phoenix requested an adverse inference instruction for the abandonment of evidence against SRC and then for the late production of the electronically stored information. David, tell us about the impact that an adverse inference decision can have on you in a case.
Well, it obviously isn't a good thing, and how bad it is, I think, depends on how strong the court's instruction is. I think it can range from being harmful to being devastating. And just for example, if the court gives a standard out of many model jury instruction books, the kind of bland, if you find that the party didn't produce or destroyed evidence and they haven't reasonably explained why, you may draw an adverse inference. That's kind of mild and may not have a serious impact on the case. But once it gets beyond that and the court gives a specific instruction about specific evidence, or if it gets to the kind of thing that happened in the Morgan Stanley case where the court, as a sanction, tells the jury to accept as true allegations of fraud in the complaint, then it reaches the devastating end. And I think Judge Shindlin, who decided the Zubilek case, it was actually in Zubilek 4, really stated it well, and her statement's actually cited in the Phoenix 4 case. And she says, an adverse inference instruction is a severe sanction that often has the effect of ending litigation because it is often too difficult a hurdle for the spoliator to overcome. In other words, the spoliator has to settle because the adverse inference instruction is going to destroy their case in front of the jury.
Tom, why do you think the judge ultimately decided not to grant an adverse inference instruction despite the abandonment of 10 computers when litigation was foreseeable and despite the fact that SRC did not search the hard drives of the servers? The judge also didn't grant the adverse inference instruction for the late production of electronically stored information. So why do you think?
Good question. Preliminarily, I wanted to note that the courts they seem to be going through some growing pains in dealing with these types of sanctions. There's a circuit split over what standard should apply when the courts are determining whether an adverse inference instruction is warranted. For example, this Phoenix 4 case was decided in the Second Circuit by the Southern District of New York, and it applied the Second Circuit's residential funding standard, which is a pretty harsh standard because it's possible for the court to impose an adverse inference instruction if there's a showing of ordinary negligence. If you're in the other circuits, such as the Fifth, the Eighth, or the Tenth Circuit, a more forgiving standard, at least from the point of view of counsel who's accused of spoliating the evidence, in those circuits, there's a standard of bad faith that must be shown. But as for why this court decided against ordering an adverse inference instruction, I'm really not sure, and I wouldn't want anybody on this call to take away from this case the message that it's okay to abandon 10 PCs and not try and deal with them at a time when litigation was foreseeable, and not make an effort to follow up with your IT people to determine if there's information that relates to a company, relates to the dispute. So I don't want anybody to take that message away from this situation. My take in reading the case is that this judge recognized that an adverse inference instruction, depending on how it's phrased, could conceivably be a death sentence for the case, and it seemed to me this judge was reluctant to impose that type of extreme remedy based on the fact of this case. I'm reading between the lines. It seems like the court had concluded that this company, SRC, was bumbling and disorganized in its business affairs, and at least with respect to the 10 computers that were destroyed, and it seemed to be reluctant to put the hammer down on that point. And on the second point, where there was a late production of this is the paper production we were talking about, the court concluded that there was a prima facie case of that warranted an adverse inference under the Second Circuit standard, but that it nonetheless concluded that standard of an adverse inference wasn't warranted because the data was ultimately produced. So it seemed to be kind of a no harm, no foul approach. I just want to make one quick follow-up point, just so everyone knows that there are cases where the courts will affirm adverse inference instructions. There was a case decided in April of this year called World Courier versus Barone by the district court in California that actually applied the same Second Circuit standard. And the citation for that is 2007 Westlaw 1119196. And that was a case where some relevant data was destroyed on a hard drive by the defendant's husband. And the defendant said, hey, it was my husband. I can't control my husband. And the court said, I don't think so. There are sanctions that are warranted. So be careful about this stuff.
Okay, Monica, the judge did come down very hard, though, on SRC's outside counsel here. Why did that happen, and what are the lessons to be aware of as outside counsel?
Carl, this is the kind of case that frightens outside lawyers to the core. The last page of the opinion orders the SRC defendants and the law firm to reimburse Phoenix equally for costs and attorney's fees relating to the motion and also for the redepositions of certain witnesses. And you hate to try to read too much between the lines of an opinion. I think it's important to take these cases for what they say, but it's hard to put yourself in the shoes of the lawyers or the clients behind the scenes. But I will note this. First of all, when the law firm was hired, which was long after, you know, after the events in issue, it promptly gave instructions to the client to gather relevant information. The client came back and said that they had done so. The client represented that they didn't have electronic data, which to me makes sense given that the company's no longer in operation. And they didn't believe there was any relevant information on the servers, and they were right to a point. A typical look at the server would not have revealed any relevant electronic information because, as you mentioned, it was in a partitioned section of the server that was not mapped, and thus, if even an IT professional had taken a look at it, they may well not have seen it and not have thought that it was hidden from view. So I actually find the court's ruling here a little bit incredible to suggest that the firm failed in its obligation to locate and timely produce that evidence, because what it means to outside lawyers, if you take this at face value, is that you can't rely on what your client tells you. You can't rely on your client to say that information does or doesn't exist, whether on a computer or otherwise, and in effect put the burden on the law firm to basically hire, I think you'd have to hire an IT expert to go make sure that there isn't something hidden from view, which is not normal. It's not common. And so I think the only way the firm could have met that obligation here would be to hire someone to personally search the servers just in case the clients were missing something. There are also instances, and I certainly don't want to suggest that, this is one of them, but where a judge doesn't fully understand technology and doesn't understand the standard to which the lawyers are being held, that's just part of litigation. As with any other aspect of litigation, you have to understand your judge and your judge's perspective. But I do think this is the type of case where if you read the facts, they do not seem terribly sensational as it relates to the outside law firm, and yet the law firm now has the black mark of having this sanction imposed on them.
You may have answered this question, but David, how can a law firm protect itself from facing these types of charges and conduct a methodical search for electronically stored information?
Well, it's difficult under the circumstances of this case, and this is kind of a harsh result, particularly as to the law firm, and does put a kind of onerous obligation on the attorneys. But, I mean, just a few pointers. The overriding one is to prepare. Attorneys who are going to work in this area have to have sufficient advanced knowledge about the legal and technical issues to know what they can deal with and to know when they need additional resources like a computer forensics consultant. In addition, they should be prepared kind of like with an action plan like the client should have, you know, with outlines and checklists, not that that's all you're going to do, but when you go into one of these cases to know ahead of time what you're going to do and carry it out. To conduct a thorough and methodical search for sources of ESI, to follow up on that and ask questions, and to document what you've done. And I think what the judge is saying here justify the imposition of sanctions is I didn't expect the attorneys to be computer forensics experts, but if they would have asked the client, what was your IT setup like at your earlier site, how were things connected together, and what kind of information did you have, that would have led to at least a question of whether or not there was anything on the servers, which in turn would have led to the need for a forensics consultant. As I mentioned, a lot of observers think this is kind of a harsh result for the attorneys, but you have to be prepared and be very methodical and follow up to not get into that kind of situation. And I think even if you do, there may be situations like this where the typical law firm working in this area is going to have problems.
Hey, Carl?
Yep, and actually, Jim, maybe you want to answer this question.
Oh, no, don't do that. Before I do that, can I just ask a question to Monica, David, and also to Tom? Monica pointed out the fact of how outside counsel kind of like this fell down heavily on them as far as what their duty was. And my question to the three panelists is in terms of your own firm, are you hiring certain, like I'll call it expertise, within your firm that can be brought to the table so that when you would take that engagement from a client that involves e-discovery, you've got someone who can ask those questions so you just aren't relying just on what the company tells you? And if you're not hiring expertise internally, are you partnering with or looking for certain experts that you can bring to the table with you, again, when you have those initial engagements with your client?
As to my firm, I can say that we do both. We have an in-house litigation support staff that has technology expertise. One of them used to work on the vendor side, and the other one came out of our IT group and learned about e-discovery. And so the two of them run the e-discovery component of our practice from the technology side. They assist our lawyers with asking the right questions and understanding the answers. I have to reiterate, though, in this case, I'm not sure we would have done anything differently from what the law firm in that case did. You know, when a client says we don't have anything, you can't really go barging onto the premises just to double check that. But in certain cases, we do use outside vendors as well. It depends on the complexity and size of the case. It's not cost efficient for most mid-sized law firms to maintain massive e-discovery capabilities in-house. And so as with in the old-fashioned days, the sort of outside copy jobs versus inside copy jobs, there are times where you want to bring in greater resources than you maintain in-house.
Mm-hmm. Do either Tom or David have anything else to add to that, or do you do the same thing that Monica does for her firm?
This is Dave. We basically do the same thing, except that we rely to a very limited extent on our own IT personnel. You know, we'll get basic information about networks and technology and things like that from them, but once it goes into client systems, we use consultants. And I'll be talking about in-house versus outside a little bit in the next case, so I'll save it till then.
Yeah, this is Tom. We've used consultants and our internal IT people as well, but I have to say that in a couple of my cases, I've really been assisted by knowledgeable paralegals who, a couple of them have worked for vendors and really know how to speak the language and understand the concepts. Even though I've done quite a bit of work with this, my eyes can definitely glaze over when vendors start talking to you about DAT files and all kinds of heavily jargony kind of IT type concepts. So it's always been helpful to me to have somebody there, whether as a consultant or paralegal, to kind of help translate. But I agree with Monica that I'm not sure any expert help like that would have helped the outside counsel in this case, and it certainly is a sobering opinion.
Well, we have an IT expert on the panel here, Kevin. Jim Mikewitz as well. But Kevin, you have a strong systems background as well as being an attorney. Were the mistakes made here of not finding information on a server easily foreseeable when the litigants are not sophisticated with IT matters? And then I'm going to give you a question from the audience.
Okay. There's a couple of things to keep in mind here. I would agree with everything that Tom, Monica, and Davis said about this appearing to be a bit harsh, but I know we are talking about the middle market here. We're not talking about the mega market. But if you look at the wording that is in the opinions of cases such as Morgan Stanley Coleman and Zubelake and Prudential, you'll find that in each of those opinions, what the courts are basically doing is they're almost putting outside counsel at odds with their in-house counterparts. And that's something that's been written about a lot in the past year or so, where the courts are almost saying to us, well, you can't take your client's word for the fact that they've looked for information. You almost have to be in a position of verifying. It's sort of the old trust but verify situation, whereby, yes, you can accept the information, but you can't rely solely on what your client has told you. And that, of course, is completely different to what a lot of us have been trained over the years. As far as whether this was a problem, I think you've got a violation of one of my main tenets in electronic discovery, and that is, first of all, never allow attorneys to tell you what technology to use, and secondly, never leave the techies alone with the server. In this particular case, information that is first viewable and later is not viewable, devices that are abandoned or left or reused, things of that nature, someone has to have their finger on the pulse of these things. We're long past the days when computers were unknown boxes where people would walk by them and someone would say, well, that big thing in the corner is our computer. Now we've got the ubiquitous PCs and everything else that are out there. It doesn't matter if you're a large organization or a small organization. Everyone's got computers. You've got computers at home. You've got computers in your office. We all have BlackBerries and media streaming telephones on our hips. Kids are using instant messaging to tell us when they get home from school. We can no longer claim that we don't realize that computers are important business tools. As such, it's going to be very hard to try to state with a straight face that you didn't realize that data that's kept on computers might be important to either current business or future litigation. Searching or understanding the data is one issue. The obligation to at least preserve the data and not abandon it is well settled. So regardless of whether or not you can read it later on, and there was a mention in here about DLT tapes were created and the outside attorneys couldn't read them, my response would be holding it up to the light is not the way to do that. You need technical people to explain to you how to get that information off the DLT tape. If the tapes were created, I, for one, when I read this information, was very confused as to why, if the information was on the tape, it couldn't be read. So those are the kinds of things you have to work through. So whether or not you can read and work with the data is one issue, but the threshold issue is the fact that you do have an obligation to preserve that data. You can't leave computers behind any more than you'd be allowed to leave behind boxes of canceled checks or other kinds of documentation. It has absolutely nothing to do with whether you are or are not sophisticated in your use of IT. This is simple business acumen at this point.
Well, if you've ever left a job or had a company implode on you, and I've done that, I've left stuff behind. Anyway, there was a question from the audience. Isn't the burden on the firm ultimately? I don't think you can rely on the company's IT expertise. Presume outside IT persons should search for the docs. And Kevin, since you've been in that role, or at least involved with your IT side of your most recent company you were at, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think my reaction is the fact that it's a shared burden. Too often, people are looking for the one guy. They're looking for the one guy who does backups, the one guy responsible for information, and they're hoping that they can talk to just one individual and get whatever result they're looking for. When you're looking for information like this, there's probably going to be two, three, or four IT people that need to be consulted. So it's not just a single individual who can give you a yes or no as to whether or not these records actually exist. Along the same point, lawyers cannot just call up and call into the help desk and say, hey, did you look for those documents, and get a yes or no answer. Or once you get the answer, no, we haven't found anything, you have to follow that up and say, well, where did you look? What devices did you look on? What systems were you looking at? Did you look at backup tapes? You know, what did you physically do? And I see a lot of people getting burned because they ask a quick question, do you have anything related to this? And I likened it to playing Go Fish. You know, they say, do you have any email? And they say, no, Go Fish. And they go back and say, well, you know, I asked them, and they said they had nothing. So you can't take simplistic answers because this is not a simplistic area. You have to make sure that you're following up those issues and trying to get additional information to back it up. So if you get into this situation where you're trying to explain to a judge, Your Honor, I went in there, I talked with my client. Just saying I talked to an IT guy and he said I looked and I don't see anything won't be enough. But if you can say I went through a stage process, and one of the panelists mentioned just now about having some checklist that you can refer to, if you've got a checklisted process where you can say here's where we looked, here's what we tried, here's what we did, 9 times out of 10 the judges are going to turn around and say, well, you made a decent effort in trying to find the information, and they're not going to be as hard on you if something goes wrong.
Carol, how does it feel to be in electronic records management and on a panel filled with litigators discussing a bunch of cases? Actually, the reason I liked having Carol on this program is I think there's always another perspective to these messes, and it's the records management perspective. And do you have any lessons from this case for middle market companies regarding records management and how that could have prevented this messy issue from occurring?
Oh, yeah. In fact, two perspectives. One is that your duty to maintain records does not end with the life of the corporation. You are required to keep certain documents, depending upon the state and the type of records, for 3 years up to 30 years past the life of the corporation. There are some regulations in some industries that actually require you to pass the information on to a third party for maintenance. So this sense that, you get tired of your company and you just abandon it is simply inappropriate. And like I said, many states, they call out very specifically that documents have to be maintained for a longer period of time. The other part of it that kind of surprises me, and no offense to other panelists, but what we have learned over the past few years is that however common computers may be, people who invent information technology have demonstrated they are interested and willing in stuffing information in every nook and cranny of an information system. I work with a lot of IT directors, and most recently I'm meeting ones who say, I will not go on the witness stand and say that I affirm that every copy of a document has been deleted because I don't really know. And that really scares me. And until the information technology community understands that they are putting companies at risk with their technology, and people in information technology learn about some really basic records management principles, I think we're going to continue to see problems like this.
Okay, we're going to go into our third case.
Paul, can I just stop you?
Sure, go ahead,
Jim. I just want to point this
program was modestly out of, proceeding off the clock until you started helping. But this,
oh, great.
This is
oh,
all
thank
fans.
You.
Jim,
once
I want
again.
To encourage you because these are all good points. So go ahead.
And we can maybe cover this later, but I think the one thing about this whole thing about the burden placed on outside counsel and the reliance on the client as far as, like, systems and et cetera, is the cost issue involved in bringing in a third party or bringing in a consultant who can really almost like audit the system and then come back and say, this is what's going on. And this is an issue for the mega market, having to say, well, wait a second here, why do we have to pay so much to do this type of thing? But I think that is an issue as well. And that's why I asked the question about the law firms, if they have this kind of in-house expertise or if they have to partner with someone else. In either situation, they're going to have to probably present this to the client, say, you know, for your own good, our recommendation is that you go ahead and hire this person to go ahead and do this audit, to come back with a report, and therefore there's at least the defensibility. And I won't ask the question right now, but I think one thing is, what if the client says no? They're just not going to do that. It's just cost too much. And I would be curious if any of the law firms would walk away from that because it would be too risky of a proposition if they didn't have that in place. One other thing I just want to point out, because I think that Tom mentioned a case as well inside of one that goes prior to December 2006 rules changes, but I still think is very relevant today, is the Metropolitan Opera, the Local 100, which was decided in January 2003, Southern District of New York. But that is a really good case also for the mid-market companies about what can go wrong when you just do not have a plan and when you go ahead and rely on certain resources internally to go ahead and to do preservation and collection. So I just wanted to cite that case.
Okay. Third case is Peskov.
Could I jump in just one more?
Go ahead.
One more time, as long as the floodgates have been open. I just wanted to add one more point here about the practice of identifying kind of a point person from within the IT department to deal with these legal issues on a systemic basis. I think I've had difficulty dealing with people, with IT people, just calling them up and trying to talk to them, and many of them kind of have the attitude that this, you know, really isn't their job, and they're doing more important things like trying to prevent the company's server from shutting down. And we've found that if you can actually appoint somebody within the IT department who has some interest in the kind of the legal side of things, that can be very helpful both in promoting conversation, so you're avoiding this game of kind of 20 questions, in terms of what you're asking for, where the in-house person can become more and more familiar with the legal procedures, and in turn, a point person could be identified from the general counsel's office who develops an expertise in these technical matters, and so these two people and outside counsel is in the mix too, can kind of assist in making sure that these parties aren't talking past each other, because everybody has their own jargon, and it's certainly easy to think that you know what somebody's talking about, but really in fact not have an idea of what somebody's talking about. And so putting together a team like that, where it's somebody's responsibility to think about things from a legal perspective, somebody in IT, I think that can be very helpful. For example, if there's a merger and there's some kind of a change in the way the company stores data, or they're bringing in new storage systems from a company they're merging with, then the IT point person and the legal point person we'll be on top of that, and they'll at least be able to ask questions about, well, what does this mean for our preservation obligations and what's actually happening with this new data?
Okay. I think what I'm actually going to do, I've looked at the questions for the next case, and we've covered a lot of that ground already. I'm going to just go to the second section right now, which is sort of a panel discussion on e-discovery and records management generally.
I'm going to bless you for doing that, because I know that the next case has to do with Judge Fasciola, and I don't want it to be quoted about anything about him, so for protection purposes, I'm really glad.
It's a really good case, though. I encourage everyone to read it, and I'll ask Jim a wrap-up question on that one case just to get him on record. But anyway, Kevin, you're a multidisciplinary professional with the IT legal and business skills. And for the middle market audience who might not have had much experience in these types of cases, how important is project management in these cases? And who's the best person to oversee an electronic discovery project?
Well, project management skills are critical for making sure that these things stay on the rails. Most of the problems that I've seen crop up in discovery are due to a lack of project management more than anything else. You have to remember, you've got people running around doing collection. You've got organizations outside your organization probably processing your data. You've got lawyers developing case strategy. You've got perhaps some either internal, external, or contract people doing document review. And quite often, the various silos just don't talk to each other. And that's where these things begin to fall apart. If you're seeing more data than you expected to in the collection side, your processing people need to be made aware of that. And then the processing people need to be able to forward it onto your review people. And it can very often snowball on you if you don't have people taking a very close look at what's happening. You know, obviously the in-house and external lawyers have to have the most to gain and lose through seeing that the process is effectively managed. But the problem is that there's a lot of daily give and take that's required to get all the data collected, processed, and reviewed. And you don't really need an attorney to manage that particular process. To that end, it's probably best for the lawyers involved to delegate responsibility to someone who can handle the overall coordination for what's happening, but still working at their direction in order to preserve all the levels of privilege that you want to make sure you've got in any particular case. This is going to provide you with a fresh set of eyes to keep track of all the moving parts and make sure that nothing gets dropped accidentally. The project manager has to also understand litigation as well as the IT side of things. They have to understand both sides well enough to be able to flag problems or new issues for the attorneys as they arise. So this is kind of a unique skill set that people are looking for, and it's something that more and more organizations are deciding it's better for me to find someone, whether it's from an outside organization or whether it's somebody that I can groom within my own organization, to help to manage these things, because the money spent in either training or hiring someone on an hourly basis to try to manage all these things can really pay off huge dividends in terms of cost avoidance from either delays in the litigation, delays in processing, or, as you see with some of these cases we've been talking about today, the problems that can arise where someone says you should have foreseen this as being an issue, or you should have planned in order to make sure you've taken care of this issue, or you just didn't have the information you should have, and I'm going to provide an adverse inference to the other side. Those things can cost you a heck of a lot more than trying to make sure that you've got someone with good project management skills to keep this thing running.